'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse.
In my mind,
this is a cool watch. Cheap-ass band. And I go over here and I get a cheaper band. It's gonna break.
Shows out there.
Thank you.
And I got a lot to do.
To all our family and friends, I want you to remember this line.
Merry Christmas from the Temptations.
This is Chicago's finest internet radio show, making a world a better place, one show at a time. The George Warner Jr. Show is now on the air. Take it away, Dad.
All right.
Okay.
Clearing my throat there. I was clearing my throat in case you've heard it. Welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio, broadcasting out of the city of Chicago near the north side, right off Lake Michigan. It is much better than it was yesterday. Speaking of the weather. It is, I mean, in the city of Chicago, and I'm pretty sure around the country, where this cold and Arctic blast has been freezing the hell out of most of us. But it is a lot better today, folks. I mean, I can walk outside without gloves on, but that's it. That's it. But it's a lot much better. And for the people of Chicago and the people of Illinois, the weather is, the snow is melting, the ice is melting, so it's less slippery. It's about 35 degrees. That beats 30 below, so it's a lot better. And they say it's supposed to get better as the week progresses. That will remain to be seen. But, hey, wow, it's great. I mean, we have been in a deep freeze. Man, it seems like forever. And still, it's not even officially winter, not by the calendar. Winter doesn't start until Wednesday, the date from this show, which is the 20th, tomorrow. Today is the 20th of this show. We're live right now. You know, so winter doesn't actually start until the 21st, which is tomorrow from the date of this particular show. Now, if you're listening to the show sometime in the future, you'll know that this is a dated show. But no matter what, it's always a good show. My guest today is author Craig Wiener. Okay. If you're wondering who booked the guest for my shows, and I do have a guest almost every day, I do. I do. And it is hell of a lot of work. It is a hell of a lot of work. But I enjoy it, and that's why I do it. Why pay someone to do this when I can do it myself? And I know who I want and what I want on my show. So I'm the one who does all the booking. So if you hear about a guest on my show, if you're listening to a guest, I'm the one who booked that particular guest. No one else. I do everything because I like to save money. Anything that I can do, why pay somebody hundreds of dollars to do? And then they may not do a good job of it in the first place. I mean, why pay somebody to do a shoddy job? If I'm going to do if I want a shoddy job, I can do that myself. So whatever I can do myself, I do myself. I don't need to pay a lot of people a lot of money to do what I can do. Maybe even do it better. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. I hope a lot of you people out there heed that. If you can do something yourself, do it. Do not give up a lot of money that you may not have to pay people to do something for you when you can do it for yourself. I can understand if you can't do it, then that's fine. But if you are young and strong and energetic and smart, there's nothing you can't do for yourself. Even if you're old. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not putting down old people because I'm not that far off myself. I'm not putting down old people because you guys are really, really bright, talented, and smart seniors and elderly people out here. And I'm talking to them too. If you can do something for yourself, if you can do it, if you feel that you can do whatever you need done yourself, then to go out and hire somebody, then do it. You save a lot of money that way. You'll feel a lot better. And then you're doing something, you know, because if you retire, one of the things you don't want to do, you don't want to sit around the house and do nothing. If you're retired, you want to find something that you can get into. Find out what you can do for yourself and do it. You know what I'm saying? If you can fix a lamp, a light in a lamp, fix it. You know what I'm saying? If you can work on a computer to get it to, you know, whatever, run faster or whatever, you know, do it. Whatever you can do, do it. If you can program a computer, whatever you can do, do it. Do not pay other people to do it. And here's another thing. If you don't know what you're doing, if you don't know what you're about to do, research it. Look it up. Go to Google. Find out how to fix that lamp or how to program that computer. It's all on Google. It's all online. It's all everywhere. Whenever you want to learn how to do something, research it and find out about it. It's there. I mean, most of the stuff that I've learned, at least some of the things I've learned on my own, and I've learned by researching. You know, researching. So that's what you do. Then to go pay somebody to do it, and they do a shoddy job. And then you're out of money when you could have done it yourself, or you could have researched. So if anything you can do yourself, do yourself. Happy holidays, everybody. And Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. I almost forget to say that, because you know what? You know why? The cold weather really took a lot out of me. And I'm pretty sure a lot of other people around the world, you know, the cold weather just takes a lot of out of you. For a minute there, I thought it was going to dampen the Christmas spirit. Really. I did. But, you know, it is so nice today in the city of Chicago. I'm pretty sure people are out there caroling, you know, and some people are probably just acting a damn fool. But it's great. The weather is great. It's wonderful. And that's all I'm going to say about that. This is Christmas. Happy holidays, everybody. Open your heart to those in need. That's the greatest present that you can give anybody. That's the greatest present you can give to yourself. That's the greatest gift that you can give to yourself. Help somebody else. I think last Christmas, me and my son, we went, instead of us staying home and celebrating Christmas, we went to help other people, feed other people. We wanted to make their Christmas great. We didn't think about our Christmas. We didn't think about presents and all of this family reunion and all this kind of thing. We thought about other people who were having a hard time at it, you know. So we went and gave of ourselves free to help those in need. And I think everybody should do that. I mean, don't think of yourself. Think of those who are thinking of you, actually. Think of those who are thinking of you, and think of those who are in need, and help them. You know, get up from the table and go out and help somebody. Shelters are all around the place. I mean, food pantries are everywhere. You know, needy people are all over the place. You know, we got some people out here who try to pretend like they're needy. Yeah, of course. Try to pretend like they're needy just to beg, just to be begging, right? So you have to watch out for those kind of people, because you do have people who are trying to be slick. I'm serious. I mean, there are times when I'm going to the supermarket, I'll see the same old lady standing on the corner with a handout begging. You know, I have a heart. I have a heart. I'm a giving person. But when you see the same old person on the street corner every damn day, you walk out of the house begging, you know. And one day I discovered that this old lady that comes out and stands on the corner, she had a condo. She lived in a damn condo right down the street from me. But she just had to come out every day, every morning, every evening, and beg for change when she didn't have to. She didn't need it. It was just something she was doing. So you have to watch out. There's people out there who claim to be homeless, and they're not. They could be dressed in a costume or something, needing a shave, or they're smelly. but they're not homeless. They're trying to hoodwink you into thinking that they're homeless, so you throw them $5 or $10. You know, and more than likely, they don't even need the money. They're just out there experimenting or seeing how the public reacts to a homeless individual or just somebody out there trying to con the public. I mean, there used to be a lot of people coming from nursing homes and stuff. They'd come from the nursing homes or places like that, and they would come and stand on the corner, and they would be begging for money for the nursing. They'd get the money, and they'd take it back and give it to the nursing home staff. You know, yeah, I mean, it's a scam out there. It's not like you see a homeless person sitting out on the street with a can, shaking a can full of coins, expecting you to drop something in there. That person may be somebody who is well off, that they're just out there doing that, you know, just to see how it goes or experimenting. So watch yourself before you give up your money. Even some of these Salvation people out here with these kettles and bales, you have to watch it, because that might be phony. Anybody can go put on a red suit and a white beard and white wig and say they're Santa Claus and find a bell or something or a cup painted red and say they're Salvation Army. You have to be careful out here. This is the age of scams. People will do anything to get your money. And there is whatever it is that they think that they can do to get your money, they are going to do it. They are going to do it. And this is Christmas. This is the holidays. So these guys are out there. They're out there to get your money. Pickpockets, scammers, people saying that they're this and they're not. You have to watch yourself out here, people, and you have to be careful. And they always say, whenever you're out, make sure you pay attention to your surroundings, because if you don't pay attention to your surroundings, the bad guy is going to pounce on you. If you're paying attention to your surroundings, if the bad guy's there, the bad guy is going to say, wow, this person has spotted me. I better go. One of the things a bad guy do not want to be is spotted. But the only way he can be spotted is as if you pay attention to where you are, pay attention to what you're doing, get your face out of that cell phone, and pay attention to what's going on around you. Because the bad guy, they have no morals. They will attack you, rob you, beat you in public, in broad daylight, and get away with it. They will get away with it. You know, you can make all the police reports that you want, incident reports that you want, but the bad guy is gone. He's got your property. He's got your money. He's got everything he needs, your cell phone. He's gone. So pay attention to your surroundings when you're out here, no matter if it's the holidays or any other day of the year. Pay attention. These guys are out here, and they are out for blood, your money, or your blood, whatever comes first. You have to pay attention to your surroundings, because if you pay attention to your surroundings, the bad guy is going to see you paying attention to your surroundings, and they just may leave you alone because you have spotted them. You know what they look like. You know, so pay attention to your surroundings. It could just save your life. And there are so many people, young people in general, people just in general, with their faces down in their cell phones. You got to come up off of that, because the bad guy know you're going to be on that train, in the office or whatever, walking down the street, looking at your cell phone. That's a great sign for the bad guys. When they see you on your phone and you're not paying attention to your surroundings. But I have to say, during this cold spell and this Arctic blast that we've had in Chicago and most of the country, a lot of people have put their phones away. You didn't see many phones out here when it was 30 below. You didn't see many. They didn't have them phones out. I mean, they were trying to keep warm. But does it take a cold blast for people not to use their phones and to pay attention to their surroundings? If so, then, you know, let it be. But, you know, cell phones, I think they're great. They're becoming more expensive every day. And then some of the same phones are really, really less expensive. So if you get a cheap phone, a cheap cell phone, I don't think any of those phones are cheap, because if you buy a cheap cell phone and the plan for the phone that you have is $40, $50, $60 a month, that's not a cheap phone, you know. So keep your face out of your phone when you're walking down the street, especially during the holidays, because the bad guys are out there. They know who you are. So pay attention and stay safe. All right. You've got that from the George Wilder Jr. Show. And we are always trying to, we are here. I can't even talk, folks. We are here making the world a better place, one show at a time, always, always. And I want to say again, our greatest weakness lies in giving up. The most certain way to succeed is just to try one more time. All righty. Sorry for the delay there, folks. You have what the music stopped before I got back on the air. All right. Thank you for listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. Thank you for tuning in. Follow me on Facebook. Follow me right here. It's been fun, folks. Like I said before, it's cold in Chicago, but it's not as cold as it used to, as it was yesterday and the days and the weeks before. All righty, let's see what we got. We've got someone on the line. Let's go check this out. All right, you're on the George Wilder Jr. Show. Go right ahead.
Yeah, this is Dr. Wiener. You had scheduled me for a show.
Yeah, I know. I have you right here on my screen.
Okay.
Dr. Craig, you're Craig Wiener, right?
Yes, I am.
And you're going to be talking about HD, 8D or something to that effect?
Yeah, hyperactivity, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
Without medication.
Well, you can help kids without resorting to that if the parents want to work at some psychology. You can.
Okay. Let me do. All right, let me do this. Doctor and author Craig Wiener is on the George Wilder Jr. Show. Okay, tell us a little bit of something about yourself. Give us your name and give us a little bio, and then we can get into all of that.
Okay, so I wrote 3 books on ADHD, 2 books for professionals, and a parenting book for parents called Parenting Your Child with ADHD, A No-Nonsense Guide for Nurturing Self-Reliance and Cooperation. And it's a way to help kids who are doing these behaviors that they call ADHD learn to be more self-reliant and cooperative with the people around them. So hopefully help them learn to do better in school and to be participating in the family. And I'm a psychologist who's been in private practice since 79, and I'm an assistant professor at UMass Medical School. And I had been clinical director at a primary care facility for 23 years. And through all these experiences, I wrote these books on ADHD.
Okay, that sounds great. Wonderful. So how would you, how can you tell someone who has ADHD?
ADHD, it's, there's a list of behaviors that the parent checks off whether the youngster does the behavior frequently enough, and it has to do with whether they climb around and fidget in their seat and don't have difficulty waiting in line and don't wait their turn and are distractible when you're trying to talk with them.
Hyperactive.
Whether they're hyper and distracted and impulsive.
What about I have a son. I hate to use him as a as a pawn in this, but I know when he was small, he didn't pay attention much. When you talk to him, he would not look you directly in the eye, but he was listening to everything you were saying and just about understood everything you were saying. But he would not look you in the eye; he would look all over you. But he will be looking at you, listening to you, but understanding you. But it would seem as if he wasn't paying attention. However, he was paying attention. But to me or you, normal people, we would say he's not paying attention. He's fidgety. He's this. He's that. But he's paying attention and he's listening. But to us, it would seem as though he's not paying attention or listening.
So it could be many things, but frequently it's kind of a discomfort people have when other people, you know, if somebody's talking and you're required to listen, it's kind of an imposition that you're being controlled by the other person to have to attend to what they want to talk about. So it's somewhat of an avoidance behavior. It can be it could be lots of things, anxiety about other things, but in many cases, he's listening, but he's not really that comfortable having to submit to
eye contact.
To listening.
Yeah. Okay. And but I always tell him if he goes to a job interview and he's talking to the interviewer. I always tell him to look that guy or that girl in the eye who's interviewing you, or you will not get the job. You know, I try to instill that kind of thing into him. And he's better now. He's a lot better now. But, you know, HDHD. Okay, what are the names of your books? I mean, you told us.
Three books?
Three books.
Well, first book is called, ADHD is a learned behavioral pattern, and it's called A Return to Psychology. So I kind of look at all the arguments that make it into a biological deficit and try to show people how these ADHD behaviors are psychological. And the second book was a book for how therapists can help work with their clients to help parents and their clients with these behaviors. Mm-hmm. And I was asked to write a parenting book. It was made specifically for parents so that parents could learn how to engage the child. And so rather than control the child, to learn to persuade the child and to work with the child so the child is interested in doing the kinds of things we want the children to do. It's not just coercing them. Because coercion only works as long as you're around to do it. You don't really get much results from coercing people.
You think your books, what you write in your books, even will help the child with ADHD long into adulthood.
Exactly. That's what they're for, to create the kind of young person you want them to be, rather than just make them do things because they're afraid of you or because they're induced by a medication to complete work or concentrate. That's what the medication, but it's risky because they don't really know what are the long-term consequences of putting a kid on a stimulant medication or an amphetamine.
The
consequences for the brain.
Yeah, I'm against that too. I think that a lot of the medications you take, no matter for what kind of ailment or what kind of disease, a lot of it is just, you're just wasting your money, I think. You know, a lot of the medications, they may help the symptoms, but they will never eradicate the disease itself. So you're just going to be taking medications for the rest of your life. And that, like you say, it could affect your brain.
Especially long-term use of these drugs. So short-term probably isn't as dangerous, but long-term use of a drug as a child develops through time and reaches adolescence, what does it mean to... And people are going to have that... They're coming out with lots of studies on psychiatric meds, and they're finding out that long-term use for all the different diagnoses ends up with poorer outcomes. So they end up getting all sorts of dementia and... Poor long-term functioning with even with the schizophrenics and the other diagnostic categories.
Like you were saying, in the long run, it's going to make the symptoms and you worse if you keep using these kinds of drugs.
That's what some of the studies are showing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So how would you suggest? Without medication, I mean, your books is probably are saying it all, but without medication, how would a parent, try to alleviate some of the symptoms of ADHD without medication?
So the first thing I try to help parents do is understand that the youngster's doing something. They're not suffering from something. Mm-hmm. They're doing something. So if a kid's hyperactive, when are they hyperactive? And what are they getting out of it? Like what kind of attention, or why are they taking those risks? What are they getting from the behavior? And when are they distracted? When do they behave desperately? And why are they overreacting emotionally? What are we doing in response to these behaviors that maybe get them to repeat again? So if the kid monopolizes all the attention by touching all the objects in the room they're not supposed to touch, then the parent can't talk to their friend, or if the phone rings and the kid acts out, then the parent can't be on the phone. Or if the kid doesn't do their work, then they don't have to risk failing, or they don't have to do something that you want them to do. They can do something they want to do. So how do you get a kid to start to do the things that we think is important for the youngster to do? without the notion that you have to induce it through coercion, because that creates other problems.
Yeah. Is anything in ADHD similar to autism?
I don't think so. I think the autism is...
It's different, okay.
That's a problem of understanding social behaviors. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And that's going to be the category that now takes off like ADHD did. So you're going to have millions and millions of kids diagnosed with some variety of severity of how autistic they'd be. So if you have to be very careful about how these diagnoses are applied to people. Because as soon as you seem odd to somebody, now you're going to be labeled.
Yeah. So ADHD, does that give in to a child's learning, maybe a learning disability?
Well, so kids who have trouble learning are going to more likely do ADHD behaviors, because why would you want to participate and persist on the things you're not doing well at? So you're going to have more avoidance behaviors, and you'd have more irritability and problems. So anything, if the same youngster was doing well at something, they wouldn't show the same distracted behaviors. They would concentrate better. Like the things that they initiate and enjoy, they don't have the same problem with. So if a kid goes to school and they are successful and they compare themselves to other kids and they feel like they're competent, you're not going to get the same acting out and avoidance behaviors you would if a youngster feels they can't compete or they're not accepted at school or they're having trouble socially. So these behaviors occur under conditions where the kids have all sorts of failure rates. They don't occur when the kid has a high success rate.
Yeah. Do you have an excerpt from one of your books that you would like to read?
I don't know. I could more likely, rather than read something, just to talk with you about.
Yeah, that's fine.
See if I could get one up. It's more.
You're listening to the George. Okay.
What's that?
No, go right ahead. I interrupted you. Go ahead.
What I want parents to say is you have a relationship with your child. Not about raising your child. Discipline is about teaching your child and helping them learn how do they learn to care about other people and want to be helpful and want to achieve and develop their own skills. So you want to make it so the child has got the notion of it's a wonderful thing to learn things and a wonderful thing to do things and to be kind to people. And you really don't get that by a lot of punishments and things. You get that through helping the kid model kindness for the kid and for the child to see the benefits to working together.
One of the things that I think can get a child to really learn, especially from a parent, I think for a parent to really want her child to shine and to learn, is to give that child undeniable love. I think love will do it to getting that child to, if a child knows that they're loved, they're going to do everything they can to try to impress their parents, don't you think? If they know that they're loved.
That's right. Love is the thing that carries it. Yeah. Now, a lot of parents will say, I love the kid, great, and the kid's still having trouble with the kid, because you can love the kid, but it's how also you help the kid learn to solve problems with you. So if your child's hitting you, then you have to stop them from hitting you and say, you're going to have to stop you from hitting me, and when you're done being angry, I'll let your hand go. You're not going to sit there and let the kid hit you. Or if the kid is leaving candy wrappers all over the house. And they say, well, I'd be glad to buy these things as long as I know you're going to put them away or share them with the other people in the family. Otherwise, I just don't want to buy this stuff anymore. See, it's a way to limit that, but you do it in a way where the child sees it's a necessity to put that that limit on, or why, or what the advantage is. Or, you know, if you brush your teeth and things, take good care of your teeth, we don't have to go to the dentist quite as often. Otherwise, we have to go to the dentist and have them clean the teeth for you, and then we don't have less money to do other things. It's not if you don't brush your teeth, I'm going to take away your cell phone, or I'm going to take away your toy. It just doesn't help a kid learn anything other than to be afraid of the,
I was going to say, author Craig Reno on the George Wilder Jr. Show, can you tell us where we can find your books and give us a website where people can go and get in touch with you?
Yeah, that's great. So I have a website. It's craigreno.com. It's C-R-A-I-G. And the other name is W-I-E-N-E-R.com. So you can reach me on my website and see my books there. But the book is carried by all the Barnes & Noble stores across the country and on Amazon. So you can buy it on off the internet. And
okay, all right. Thank you. Thanks for being on the show, all right? You were great.
All right, thank you. Okay, thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. All right, that was author Craig Reno on the George Wilder Jr. Show. We are going to take a little break here, and we will be back. Thank you, folks.
You are now listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Block Talk Radio.
All right, the final tally. Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump by nearly 3 million votes. 3 million votes. Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump by 3 million votes, people. She slaughtered him. But yet, Donald Trump won the states with the more electoral votes. Clinton did not, but she beat him with the popular vote. Now, when I think of that, it makes me change my mind a little bit about what I've said in the past. Has me thinking a little bit differently. The electoral vote is what did Hillary Clinton in, not the popular vote. My thinking is, and I'm pretty sure there's a lot of other people, it should be the popular vote, should be your vote, each and every person that cast a vote on voting day or early voting, those votes should count. It seemed as though they do not count. You know, she won by a landslide. She did, seriously. But she just didn't get the electoral vote. And a lot of us are calling for an amendment to the Constitution, but we know that ain't going to happen because the Republicans love it. You know, they love it. The electoral vote worked in their favor, so they're not going to change it. It would have to be an amendment. There would have to be congressional input on this. And the Republicans control the White House. They control the Congress. So this is not going to happen because it worked in their favor. Anything that works in their favor, you think they're going to get rid of it? No. Hell no. It worked for them. It's great. They love the Electoral College. But the popular vote fell on its face. That means my vote, your vote, fell on his face. Does that mean we should stop voting? No. We got to get Rahm Emanuel. We got to get Bruce Rauner out of Illinois because these people are destroying this great state. But then again, I'm going to say this. Clinton beat Trump nearly by 3 million votes. But the electoral college is what did her in with 270 votes. Since when does 270 votes beat almost 3 million votes? Only the electoral college. And this isn't the Constitution. This is law. There's nothing shady about this. There's nothing wrong about this. There's nothing diabolical or sinister about this. This is in the Constitution. He won these votes. He's the president. You know, but there's 3 million people out here saying that he should not be in office. 3 million people. Trump has a big job of bringing America together. America right now, folks, under Donald Trump is divided. I mean, we are divided like cutting a watermelon in half. We are divided on this side and that side, one side or the other. We are totally divided. America is divided. Trump has the job. He's talking about 8 years in office. You know, he has the job of bringing this country together, but I really don't think Trump gives a damn about bringing this country together. I think he just can't believe that he's president of the United States. He can't believe it. Trump is saying to himself, oh, what did you people do? Put me in office with all my baggage? Yeah, but he's there. So, you know, and I've said this many times on the show, on the George Wilder Jr. show right here. I said, Trump is the president of the United States. Let him be the president of the United States. You know, he's got 4 years before he runs again. There's a chance to vote him out and a chance to deal with this electoral college. So we got 4 years to do that. If not, then Trump will be reelected or some other Republican would be reelected. So let Trump be Trump. Let Trump be president of the United States. Let him do what he's going to say he's going to do. Because to me, it looks like Trump is trying to back off of some of the things that he said that he was going to do during his campaign. And if he does, his supporters are going to be pissed off and he will not be reelected as he's looking forward to. I've said this many times, and Trump is no different. Once a politician wins an office, a governmental office, the first thing that they're thinking about is running again, getting reelected. They're thinking about getting reelected before they even sit down in their office. How can I get reelected? That's the first thing that Bruce Rauner thought when he won the office of governor in Illinois. I'm gonna run again, and I haven't and haven't done a damn thing yet. But they want to run again, you know. So let Trump be Trump. Of course, Bruce Rauner is emboldened by Trump's win. That's why he's acting so damn crazy around Illinois, being an asshole. He's emboldened by Trump's win. He's emboldened by the fact that Trump did not show his taxes. He did not present his taxes because his taxes would have shown probably that he has ties with Russia. Or he's not as rich as he say he is. But by being president of the United States, he's going to get even richer than what we thought he wasn't. He was not rich, but if that makes any sense. You know, but anyway, you know, he won this by not submitting his taxes. He won this by, you know, all those salacious allegations against him, all the tapes and grabbing the pussy and all of that kind of thing. That did not. It worked against Trump with the popular vote, but it did not work against Trump with the electoral vote. The electoral vote people, they wanted Clinton out. They didn't want to see Obama. They didn't want to see a third term Obama with Hillary Clinton in office. But Hillary Clinton clearly won the popular vote. The people, she won the people's vote. Donald won 270 votes. That doesn't make sense, does it, folks? I want to say this again because it just, my head is twisted because of this. Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump by almost 3 million votes. 3 million, the popular vote, okay? Donald Trump won the presidency with just 270 votes. When does 270 votes beat almost 3 million votes? You tell me. This is why so many people are pissed off, angry, and upset at the Electoral College. Because the Electoral College just spit on our vote. Just said our votes weren't worth a damn. You know, so, but I'm pretty sure I'm being a little bit extreme on that. But, you know. But still in all, it doesn't mean for you to stop voting. Your vote did count. Your vote did mean something. Your vote went to Hillary. Even though she lost, it still went to Hillary. You know, but the Republicans, they are controlling the country right now. They are in charge. Okay? They are the ones who hold the money strings. Okay? They can go after your Social Security check. They can go after your food stamps. They can go after your welfare check. Anything that's coming from the government monetarily, they can cut. They can cut. It doesn't matter. And you'll be out on the damn streets. You know, so this is why I say, do not give up on voting. Keep voting. This is a time not to feel sad or angry at the results of the election. This is the time to be more emboldened. This is the time to be more of an advocate, of a leader, a community leader, an advocate, you know, out there fighting a good fight for the people. This is not a time to sit back and cry and give up. Because the Republicans are controlling everything. That is just what they want you to do. That is what they want you to do. But remember, the Republicans can't do everything in Congress because the Democrats are there to stop them and the independents are there to stop them. You know, if they try to vote on something, they're going to pass something. They're going to need Democratic and independent votes also. Okay. And, like I said, we've got Donald Trump as president, so we might as well sit back, shut up, and see what he does. See what he does. I mean, I didn't vote for him. I mean, almost 3 million people out here who cast their ballots are saying that Donald Trump is not their president. Literally. They're saying that Donald Trump is not their president. And the folks who, the 270 electoral votes are saying Donald Trump is our president. It just behooves me that the Electoral College transcends the popular vote. That's, we've discussed this before. I mean, years ago, we've talked about the Electoral College years ago. It's just crazy. I mean, it's crazy that the popular vote was trashed by the electoral vote. It's just not right. It's just not right. You know, if you don't know what the electoral vote, college electoral vote, if you don't know what that is, we're going to have someone on the show to explain that in the near future. It could be tomorrow. It could be Thursday. Someone to explain the electoral college votes, because a lot of people don't understand it. And I can see why. I mean, I can understand. I mean, you can be as smart as you want to. You can be the most intelligent person in the world. But you, like me and others, you know, what the hell is it? An electoral college vote? What the hell is that? So we're going to have someone on this show in the near future, the very near future, to explain that to you, my audience, and to a lot of us, you know. But I pretty much know what it is. But, you know, you got some people out there who do not. And they are still trying to get their heads around it. If you want to research it, read your Constitution. It's in there. Okay. You've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio. Folks, we will be right back.
You are now listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
Barack Obama has had a busy first 7 years as president. So in this video, I'm just going to lay out all the things his administration's been able to accomplish. President Obama kept his biggest campaign promise and ended the Iraq War. And he kept the homeland extremely safe, unlike his predecessor, who allowed a massive terrorist attack against both our largest city and our capital. President Obama also prohibited the use of torture, which had been rampant under Bush. He created the New START Treaty with Russia to reduce each country's nuclear weapons arsenal. A year after his inspiring A New Beginning speech in Cairo, young people armed only with smartphones and laptops took to the streets in the Arab Spring uprising in Egypt that quickly spread.
Do blacks commit more crimes than other races? The simple answer to this question is yes. The black population of the United States is approximately 13%, and the white population is approximately 62%. These are the FBI crime statistics for 2014, where blacks accounted for 27.8% of the total amount of arrests for that year, an obviously disproportionate amount for a population of 13%. The overall level of arrests for black people is higher than might be expected in almost every category, except for driving under the influence of alcohol. Black people accounted for most of the arrests for murder, 51.3%, robbery, 55.9%, and gambling, 58.9%. They were also significantly above average in several other categories. Weapons crimes, 40.7%, prostitution and commercialized vice, 41.8%, and aggravated assault, 33.1%. A common criticism of these figures is that they are based on arrests by police officers who may be disproportionately targeting black neighborhoods due to racial bias or profiling. However, these statistics seem to be corroborated by the National Crime Victimization Surveys, performed by the Department of Justice. The latest NCVS data is from 2008 and is collected by a random survey of 90,000 households. Blacks are consistently disproportionately represented in these surveys, correlating closely with the arrest figures. In addition to this, the number of black police officers has remained steady since 2007 at 12%, while being 13% of the population. There has been a marked rise in non-black ethnic minority officers, but despite police efforts, recruiting blacks into the police force has been challenging due to criminal background checks and a cultural attitude towards the police as an institution. Naturally, murder and non-negligent manslaughter is the category missing from the National Crime Victimization Survey, and it is also the most focused on by the media. Homicides by victim and perpetrator are often presented as percentages as victim and perpetrator by race, which gives a chart that looks like this. Most murders are committed by a perpetrator of the same race as the victim. This obfuscates the severity of the problem by making the number of murders look evenly spread between both racial categories, with a small crossover of black-on-white or white-on-black crime. However, displaying the number of murders brings the issue of disproportionate violence committed by black people into focus. When someone says, "Black lives don't matter" to "Black lives matter," this is what they mean. Black men are responsible for murdering other black men at a rate that is near parity with the murders of white men by other white men, when white men are 5 times as numerous as black men. These murders are usually committed with a handgun. So the question becomes, why? As Aristotle said in Politics, poverty is the parent of revolution and crime. There are many studies that positively correlate poverty with non-violent and violent crime, but I've chosen to use the Edinburgh Study of Youth Transitions and Crime performed by researchers from the University of Edinburgh. I've used this study because the black population of Edinburgh is approximately 1%, and the United Kingdom is a modern, industrialized, English-speaking, Christian heritage, first world democracy. This study has been done predominantly on white British people, and I want to showcase this to demonstrate that poverty has a distinct effect on people regardless of any inherent biological differences, and to remove the possibility that these results are due to racial discrimination. The Edinburgh study followed the lives of around 4,000 young people as they made the transition from childhood to adulthood, using both self-reported data from the young people themselves and linked data from a range of official sources. The researchers studied the effect of childhood poverty on violence in the teenage years, and examined its impact beyond into early adulthood. The researchers have set out 4 measures of poverty: socioeconomic status of the head of the household, whether the young person was not in education, training, or employment at age 18, whether the young person has been unemployed for more than a year at age 22, neighborhood deprivation based on census measures of poverty in the young person's area of residence. The study found that poverty had a significant and direct effect on young people's likelihood to engage in violence at age 15, even after controlling for the effects of a range of other factors known to influence violent behavior, even when taking into account of a raft of risk indicators that would be expected to increase the propensity to engage in violence, including poor family functioning, the lack of attachment to school, substance misuse, and impulsivity, and a range of protective factors that are known to act as preventatives, such as a strong and positive relationship with the parents. Young people who were living in a family where the head of the household was unemployed or in low-status manual employment, and those who were growing up in communities with high levels of deprivation, were significantly more likely to engage in violence. Household poverty appears to act as an exacerbating factor and increases the chance of such young people offending. The Edinburgh study provides evidence that children living in poverty are overrepresented among violent offenders. Even taking account of this increased risk of offending, however, children from poor backgrounds are disproportionately selected into the juvenile justice system and retained there by decision-making that is based on, amongst other things, their impoverished status. Previous work has shown that this type of systemic processing labels and marginalizes the most vulnerable young people in society, making it difficult for them to move on from offending as they mature. The system causes structural failures that prevent those in poverty from moving out of this condition, and in the longer term, this constrains opportunities and reduces life chances. As Aristotle recognized more than 2,000 years ago, poverty breeds criminal behavior. The Edinburgh study came to an interesting conclusion as to why this behavior would involve violence. For most young people from the most impoverished backgrounds, violence provides a touchstone against which identities are honed. More particularly, violence empowers and is a means of attaining and sustaining status among peers. Willingness to use violence, therefore, becomes a resource for the most dispossessed, and this becomes a persistent feature throughout the teenage years. It follows that poverty will create increased levels of non-violent crime, such as theft, burglary, or drug dealing. But in the absence of available wealth as a status symbol, impoverished young people use capacity for violence instead. According to Pew Research Center data from 2013, black children are 27.3% of the black population, but 38.4% of those living in poverty. US Census Bureau data from 2014 shows that while Overall, 18% of families in the US with children under 18 live in poverty. This number rises to 32.1% for black families. The poverty rate for black families with intact marriages drops to 10.8%, but rises dramatically in cases of unmarried single parents. 31.2% of single fathers with children under 18 are impoverished, as are 46.1% of single mothers with children under 18. These figures follow the trend of economic hardship for single parents throughout the rest of the United States, albeit slightly more exaggerated. This has resulted in the black children living in poverty outnumbering white children living in poverty, in spite of white children outnumbering black children by 3-1. U.S. Census Bureau data shows that over half of black children do not live with their biological fathers. Unmarried black mothers with children under 18 are the most impoverished demographic in American society, and they are the most common type of family structure in black communities. A 2005 study from the University of California called The Effects of Poverty and Economic Hardship Across the Generations found that economic pressure appears to be the key mechanism linking hardship to a cascade of effects on children's development. The distress caused by poverty seems to predict lower positive, i.e. self-confidence, good school performance, supportive relationship with peers, and higher negative child outcomes, i.e. antisocial behavior, depressed mood, and symptoms of anxiety. In contrast, higher family income and the investment in children's development appear to have beneficial influences on long-term developmental success. Taken together, the family stress model and investment model suggest an intergenerational transmission of poverty and economic hardship. The family stress model of economic hardship proposes that financial difficulties have an adverse effect on parents' emotions, behaviors, and relationships, which affect their parenting or socialization strategies. According to the model, the emotional distress of poverty predicts conflict and reduces warmth and support in parent-child relationships. These relationship disruptions contribute to children's emotional and behavioral problems, academic failures, and poor cognitive functioning. The investment model suggests that economic resources increase the investment parents are able to make in their children's development, promoting academic and social competencies. With increased resources, parents are able to invest in the development of their children, providing the special care, time, and services necessary to support their children's emotional needs. These investments contribute to enriched learning environments, higher standards of living, and safer homes and neighborhoods. Greater family resources appear to reduce risks associated with the stress of poverty and help create environments that promote competent development. Instability is another key factor in the emotional well-being and intellectual growth of a child. A 2013 study called The Negative Effects of Instability on Child Development, a Research Synthesis, describes the effects of poverty and instability. Children thrive in stable and nurturing environments where they have a routine and know what to expect. Although some change in children's lives is normal and anticipated, sudden and dramatic disruptions can be extremely stressful and affect children's feeling of security. Within the context of supportive relationships with adults who act as a buffer against any negative effects of instability, children learn how to cope with adversity, adapt to their surroundings, and regulate their emotions. When parents lack choice or control over change, they may be less likely to support their children in adapting to the change. Unbuffered stress that escalates to extreme levels can be detrimental to children's mental health and cognitive functioning. The experience of economic instability causes increased material hardship, particularly when families lack personal assets. Low family income negatively affects children's social, emotional, cognitive, and academic outcomes, even after controlling for parental characteristics. Children's cognitive development during early childhood is most sensitive to the experience of low family income. Parental employment instability is linked to negative academic outcomes, such as grade retention, lower educational attainment, and internalized and externalizing behaviors. The effect on grade retention is strongest for children with parents in a high school education or less, whereas the effect on educational attainment is stronger for blacks than whites, males, and firstborn children. In dual-income households, the father's job loss might be more strongly related to children's academic outcomes than the mother's job loss. Job instability leads to worse child behavioral outcomes than when a parent voluntarily changes jobs, works low-wage jobs full-time, or has fluctuating work hours. Family instability is linked to problem behaviors and some academic outcomes, even at early ages. Children's problem behaviors further increase with multiple changes in family structure. Family transitions that occur early in children's development, prior to age 6, and in adolescence, appear to have the strongest effects. While young children need constant caregivers with whom they can form secure attachments, adolescents need parental support, role models, and continuity of residence and schools to succeed. Children demonstrate more negative behaviors when they lack the emotional and material support at home that they need to smoothly handle a family transition. Poverty is bad for children's emotional and cognitive development, and poverty is more likely to be the consequence of single-parent households. The next factor to consider is the subculture many of these young people are inculcated into. It should be no surprise that large numbers of delinquent, impoverished young men, with poor education and lacking in fatherly role models, would find acceptance within criminal gangs. In 2012, it was estimated that there were 30,000 gangs operating within the United States, with over 800,000 members. Blacks make up over 35% of these gangs, while whites make up less than 12%. These gangs are, of course, predominantly young men, and they are mostly located in large cities. Gang violence accounts for a hugely disproportionate amount of violent crime. Gangs are responsible for an average of 48% of violent crime in most jurisdictions, and up to 90% in several others. Major cities and suburban areas experience the most gang-related violence. Local, neighborhood-based gangs and drug crews continue to pose the most significant criminal threat in most communities. Aggressive recruitment of juveniles and immigrants, alliances and conflict between gangs, the release of incarcerated gang members from prison, advancements in technology and communication, and Mexican drug trafficking organization involvement in drug distribution have resulted in gang expansion and violence in a number of jurisdictions. As covered earlier, black people accounted for most of the arrests for murder at 51.3%, robbery at 55.9%, and gambling at 58.9%, and was significantly above average in several other categories. Weapons crimes at 40.7%, prostitution and vice at 41.8%, and aggravated assault at 33.1%. These are all common gang activities, and are without a doubt raising the resulting statistics for black crime. You may have noticed that the statistics for black crime have often been juxtaposed against Hispanic crime, with Hispanics having a higher rate of poverty and criminal gang membership, but a lower propensity for violence. I think this can be adequately explained by a lower rate of single-parent families, 31.2%, and a strong cultural tradition of deep familial ties, but I do not have any data or studies to validate this. So, why do black people commit more crimes? To be specific, young black men commit more crimes, far more than any other racial demographic. They are much more likely to come from an unstable, impoverished, single-parent, matriarchal household. They are more likely than young white men to lack a strong male role model. They are much more likely to seek acceptance in gang culture, leading to the acquisition of a criminal record, reducing employment prospects, and putting the individual into a downward spiral of poverty, which further incentivizes criminal behavior as a source of income. If you don't mind me speaking in more generalized terms and giving my opinions on the matter, it seems to me that these people are victims of circumstance. For many black men, the deck has already been stacked against them from their earliest days. They suffer from many societal handicaps that are beyond their control that directly affect their cognitive abilities and emotional well-being, and find themselves with reduced options from social stigma attached to poverty before any other factors need to be introduced. So I know what you're thinking. This is the white man's fault, isn't it? And the answer is no. There is no one group at which the finger can be pointed with any reliability to say, you did this. If I may conjecture, I think the fact that black people can be visually distinguished from white people has provided an intellectually lazy trap in which it's easy to fall. It's very convenient to self-validate by inventing excuses for one's own poor choices to project the responsibility for them onto mythical concepts like white supremacy and dismiss other successful black people as Uncle Toms. Not only does it allow one to place the blame on an entity that can never refuse it, but it also allows one to ignore convenient facts regarding the inconsistency of this white supremacy and its apparent concern with the welfare and social advancement of black people. So how can this be fixed? The good news about all of this is that it is completely within the power of black people to solve the problems plaguing the black community. The first and, in my opinion, most...
Yeah. Who is it? All right, welcome back to the George Wilder Jr. Show, 347-857-1762. You can follow me on Facebook. Follow me right here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm all over the place, LinkedIn, Instagram, you name it. I'm there trying to publish my books, get the word out about my books. Well, I mean, what author is not going to do that, right? We all writers. We all want people to know what we write and what we read. I'm not trying to get famous, folks. I don't give a damn about fame. I just love to write. I just love doing it. It's fun. I mean, I start grinning and laughing if something that I'm putting down on paper is amusing. So I just love doing it. Okay, something was thrown across my desk. Population lost in Illinois for the third year. I mean, I've talked about this in past shows. Of course, people are leaving Chicago. Of course, people are leaving the state of Illinois. Why? Because we've got these two clowns running everything, or should be leading, who are not leading. And I'm talking about Governor Bruce Rauner, and I'm talking about Mayor Emanuel, the two biggest reasons to why people are cutting and leaving Illinois. Illinois is the third largest state in the country, in America. We have New York, then we have Los Angeles, and then we have Illinois. Illinois is going to be the soon... If people keep leaving like they are, and they are leaving, businesses, companies, you name it, they're leaving. But you're never going to hear that from Rahm Emanuel. You're never going to hear it from Governor Bruce Rauner, because they don't want you to really think that. They don't want you to really know that. You have to find it out for yourself. They will deny it. You know, people are leaving. We're going to be... Illinois is going to become the fourth or fifth largest state because people are leaving. They are not attracting any businesses of any significance. Businesses are leaving. People are moving. People are leaving the west and south sides of the city because of high crime. And only people who are staying in those areas are the ones who can afford to leave. They cannot afford to leave. So they have no choice but to stay. But those who can afford to leave those crime-ridden areas, they're leaving. Those who can afford to leave Chicago, they're leaving. Those who can afford to leave the state of Illinois, they're leaving. But if you can't afford to leave the state of Illinois, you're stuck. You are stuck. Or maybe you just a die-hearted person and you're going to stay and fight for your state. That's another thing. But people are leaving Chicago. There's numerous reasons why, besides the two I just mentioned. High taxes, for instance. Taxes are the number one reason why people are leaving Chicago. High taxes. Inflation. That's another one. I mean, high taxes and inflation can actually go together. High rents. Chicago is one of the most expensive cities to live in. You have to have money, some kind of money, if you want to be a resident of the city. I mean, if you want decent housing, you're going to pay for it. I mean, you can find, you can go to the low-end areas of the city or anywhere and find cheap housing, really cheap housing that you can. But if you want to live in something of significance, of value, you're going to pay for it. If you want to, if you have an ego and you got to live in something that you're going to pay for it. If you want a decent car, you're going to pay for it. You know, this is an expensive town. I mean, If the mayor is not digging in your pockets, the businesses are, the government is. High taxes is the number, I would think, the number one reason for people leaving Illinois. The second, I would probably say crime. Crime. And the governor knows this, and the mayor knows this. Crime. And also the police superintendent. He knows it. But will you ever hear one of these people admit it? That people are exiting? No. But they know it. They know this. They can tell you better than I do, but they're cowards and they won't tell you. People are exiting Chicago in droves, and I can't blame them. Like I just got through saying, if people can afford to leave and they want to leave, they're going to go. But most people, especially on the south and west sides of the city, they're staying because they can't afford to leave. They're on welfare. They're on food stamps. They're getting governmental housing. They can't afford to leave. They'll be homeless if they try to leave. I mean, they got, you know, kids, you know, boyfriends, pimps. They can't afford to go anywhere. And these are the areas with the highest crime rates. These are the areas where the police, they don't have a plan or solution in bringing down the crime rates. But they're out here smiling and grinning and trying to play Santa Claus. It's when they should have their asses on the south and west sides of the city stopping monumental crime that is taking place. It's just awful. And people are leaving in droves. And if I was the mayor of the city of Chicago, this would piss me off. I would be very upset. I would be doing everything I can to keep the residents of Chicago here, especially the ones that can contribute to the economy. I would be doing everything. I mean, Murray Emanuel, he's the guy who enacted these high-ass property taxes. I mean, we have the highest in the country. Now, if these people are leaving, they have good jobs, good futures, their careers, they're career-minded people. If they leave, and they are, they're taking their tax dollars with them. And that's bad for the mayor. Because if you're taking your tax dollars with you, you know, you can't pay those high-ass taxes. So I think he screwed up in that effect. So if the people who can afford to pay these high-ass taxes leave the city of Chicago, who does that fall on? That falls on the poor, the working poor. It falls on the poor. The poor has no choice but to pay these highest taxes because they can't go nowhere. They can't afford it. They don't make enough money. But the little money that they do make, here comes the mayor with these high-ass property taxes taking their money away from them. And here comes Cook County raising taxes on sodas and every damn thing else. Sales taxes on everything else. You go buy a 2-liter Coke, you're going to pay 20 cents, a 20 cent tax. Taxes up the kazoo, and that's all they seem to do, and they do it with a straight face. And they know that most of us are pissed off and angry at this. So that is the two main reasons to why people, I'm sure there's a third, and I'll get to that tomorrow. Two main reasons why people are exiting Illinois: high property taxes and crime. Maybe Emanuel and Bruce Rauner. That's four. But anyway, it's a damn shame. It's awful. We got to pull ourselves out of this, folks. We have to do something. I mean, these people have destroyed Illinois, and they're going to keep on destroying it until we vote their asses out in 2018.
Bombs begin to fall. Heaven help the black man if he struggles one more day. Heaven help the white man if he turns back away. Heaven help the man who kicks the man who has a crawl.
I want to thank everybody for listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. Join me tomorrow. Join me Thursday. We will be back with more good stuff on the George Wilder Jr. Show. And once again, I want to say Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. I mean, we're going to be another year older, right? Some of us going to be glad to see that that extra year, another year added on to your birthday. Some of us are not. Can't stop it from coming. So I want to say thanks for listening. Make sure you tune in to the George Wilder Jr. Show 4 days a week, Monday through Thursday, 6 to 7:30. It's always fun. It's always a gas. We're going to say goodbye here, folks. Hope to see you tomorrow at the same time. Bye-bye.